Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
You think that certain things are important. You stress out about them. Like, you get anxious about them. You think like, oh, well, should this blue be this shade or this shade? Or should I use this typeface or that typeface? And it's like, it doesn't matter. Like, I've been a designer for 20 years, and like, I say this knowing that the weight of it, but it's like, it takes self-reflection or introspection to think about like what really matters. We put all of this weight on these other things, on these periphery things, because it feels like we can make progress there. It feels like, oh, I can change the typeface here. I can change the logo, or I can hire another designer. I can pick another Squarespace template. It feels like those things are moving us forward. It's just like when people ask like J.K. Rowling or Stephen King, like, oh, well, what software did you use to write your book?
Right.
It's like, who the fuck cares? Like, what does that, what, why?
Yeah.
Why?
Like, I used a napkin, to be honest.
Exactly. Though, that's not the thing that makes them good.
Yeah.
It's not.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Paul, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, sir. It is so good to talk again.
Yeah. So you actually were a guest way back when we were called Blogcast FM. In fact, I think you were one of the last guests we had under the old brand. And that conversation, as I was saying before we hit record here, really resonated with me so much that I have quoted that conversation over and over over the years. And, you know, huge fan of your work. But before we get into everything that you're up to, your amazing new book, I want to start by asking, what did your parents do for a living? And what impact did that end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
Sure. My dad was a mechanical draftsperson. So he drew machinery parts for a living. Mostly he just whistled and ate chocolate at his drafting board, his drafting desk. He did that job forever, I think, for the entire length of time that I was alive. And he retired, and he actually did get like the gold watch. Like, this is such another, he's in his 80s now. This is such a different era of how work works, but he had the retirement party in the gold watch. My mom, up until my sister's a year younger, up until we were probably 13 or 14 years old, she was a stay-at-home mom. And after that, she worked for a charity and ran the corporate donors program for a big charity. I don't really think I took anything from the way that they worked and applied it to how I work. Because I think that work has shifted. I think that the way work worked 30, 40 years ago is different than now. So it's cool that they had fairly stable jobs and they had jobs that they really enjoyed. But I think my path ended up being slightly enormously different.
Yeah. Did your dad, from being a mechanical draftsperson, pass on any lessons in craft and meticulousness? Because it sounds like something to me that would require a lot of attention to detail. And I imagine maybe unknowingly you learned some things as a designer from that.
Yeah, I mean, genetically, I think that I've always been drawn to like shapes and lines and that sort of thing. His handwriting is like, it could be a typeface. It is so perfect. Even now, like, he's in his 80s, like, he barely writes. But when he writes, like, when I get an envelope from them, which isn't even very often, his writing is a font. Because every single E is exactly the same. Every single A, every single Q. My writing's garbage. It's just garbage. I was even working with, because I had to, like, when you publish a book, the publisher sends you a bunch of stickers that you sign and that they put in the book, because it's cheaper to send stickers than entire books to me and then back to other people. And I showed my wife what my signature looks like, because I had to sign the books. And she's like, "That's awful. Like, why do you have such a crappy signature?" And so her and I worked on it to kind of get like, because she's like, "That doesn't look like a good signature. That doesn't look like a signature of an important person." No, not an important person. She's like, "You need to work on your signature." And so her and I worked on it a little bit. So that the signature for when I have been signing books has been slightly different than like the one that I sign on the back of checks and that. But I think it does look a bit nicer, to be honest. But writing is just not my style. I'm also left-handed. So whenever I write anything, everything just smudges anyways. It's just not good. It's just not a good scene. That's why I type.
Yeah, I can relate. I mean, I do all of my writing by hand to start with. And that's one of the challenges with it is that it's just chicken scratch. But I find the process of writing by hand to be really meditative. And it just, I think it fundamentally changes the way that you write. So
yeah.
One thing I wonder is, you having, you know, been around parents who've had this very conventional career path, what advice did they give you about careers? What is the narrative that you were exposed to growing up about work? Because it seems like you seem have just overcome that narrative completely.
Yeah, I have. It's funny. I think that the first 20 years of my life were me, I guess, pursuing goals that well-intentioned adults thought was the best course of action for me. So I did well in high school, and so I was really drawn to computers. I set up the computer labs. I think the final project for that, and this was like the first or second year that there was a computer course in school. I'm old. This is the first or second year that there's a computer course in my high school. And my friends and I built a video game that we submitted as the final project. And I don't think the teacher could grade it other than playing the game because he didn't really know programming very well. Mm-hmm. So adults at the time, like teachers and my parents and guidance counselors, I guess, were like, well, you should go to university. You do well. You can get into any university pretty much and like get a degree in computer science. And then by doing so, you'll be setting yourself up for a great job that you can go and get at any company. My uncle actually worked for IBM for quite a while. I think he retired when he was 35 though. So they hired him young and then he retired young. But I guess, so I went to university and I was doing that and I figured this isn't fun. Like I love computer programming. I love making things, but instead of doing my assignments, I was making websites. Cause at the time, this was like the mid 90s. And at the time the web was just starting and the web was getting graphic. Not graphic, like violent or sexual, right. but graphic, like images.
Yeah.
And I was just spending all my time doing that. I enjoyed it and I loved it. And it's funny, I made a website that was like a precursor to Urban Dictionary. I ended up selling the database. And so it was a slang dictionary. I ended up selling the database from that when I closed it to Urban Dictionary. And so it was a site, I think it was called like Pseudo Dictionary, something like that. And it ended up getting like ridiculously popular or viral or whatever you want to call it. And I was doing like radio talk shows in like 1997 or 98, talking about a website with like disc jockeys that didn't really understand what the web was. It was in Wired magazine. And I ended up getting a job offer because of it. And I was so bored at school at the time. And I was like, maybe I should just go work. And the job offer was pretty good. So I remember two conversations. The first conversation was with the dean of computer science, who was like, I told him I'm going to quit. And he was like, well, two things are going to happen. The first is that you're going to regret quitting. And the second is that you'll be back and you'll be older and you'll be pissed off that you're back and you're older. And I'm like, all right, hindsight will tell. And then the second conversation was with my parents, like, hey, mom, dad, I'm quitting university. Luckily, I was paying for university, so I didn't really feel that obligation to them. They weren't paying for it. I was. But it was still a weird conversation to be like, hey, I'm actually veering from this path that all of these adults have said is the right path. They were, I guess, they were cool with it. They were understanding of it, but they were also trepidatious and like, I hope this works out kind of thing. And I mean, that was like 20 odd years ago. So it kind of has. And now I don't think they know what I do, man. Like, to be honest, I think they understand that I write because they have my book. My granddad, who is 93, emailed me. Well, his wife emailed me because he didn't know how to use email yesterday, saying that they had seen my book in a bookstore. And that was like, that's understandable. But as far as like making courses and software and all of that and blogging and newsletters, they still don't get it. But they've always been accepting of it. And I guess cheering on me not failing, mm-hmm. I guess it's probably the best way to put it.
Yeah. Interesting. It's funny you say that, because I remember the longest time my dad would just tell people that I worked with computers. And I was like, Dad, I don't work. I use a computer to make, you know, do my work. But other than that, I don't know a damn thing about a computer. So
exactly. I'm not tech support.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. So really interesting stuff. So I want to, you know, you kind of have given us a preview of the trajectory that has led you here. And before we get into a company of one, I want to revisit this conversation that you and I had 4 or 5 years ago about this whole, I want you to make me a website that looks like Danielle Laporte's, because that was one of those things that I never forgot, so much so that I ended up writing an entire book about that. Why do people do that? Like, and particularly, you know, I mean, what is it that they think is going to come from that? And how do you talk them out of that, more importantly?
Yeah, I think my favorite writing that I've read lately that sticks in my mind, like that story stuck in your mind, was knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit and wisdom is not putting it on a fruit salad. Mm. And I think that a lot of people see how, like, they see this track for success, or they see a successful person out in the world, and they focus on the wrong things that made them successful. Like, Danielle isn't successful because her site has always looked fucking amazing. I mean, I don't even do it anymore and it still looks great.
Yeah.
Like, but that's the thing that they see. They see, like, oh, well, if I just have a site that looks like that, then I can be popular or make revenue or have like a business that's talked about. And it's not the case. Like, arguably, and I know this would never happen, but she could have a site that looks like garbage and still do well. Yeah. Like, I don't think that's, but I think that people, especially people starting out, and I don't even think it's not even a knock on them. It's just more, like, you don't know what you don't know when you start, right? Like, you think that the things are important. You think that certain things are important, and you stress out about them. Like, you get anxious about them. You think, like, oh, well, should this blue be this shade or this shade? Or should I use this typeface or that typeface? And it's like, it doesn't matter. Like, it's not like it can be, like, I've been a designer for 20 years and, like, I say this knowing that the weight of it, but it's like, there are things that are really important in work that we do, and there's things that aren't. And a lot of times it's easier to focus on the things that aren't important, mm-hmm. because it's hard to think about the things that are. It takes, like, self-reflection or introspection to think about, like, what really matters. We put all of this weight on these other things, on these periphery things, because it feels like we can make progress there. It feels like, oh, I can change the typeface here. I can change the logo, or I can hire another designer. I can pick another Squarespace template. And it feels like those things are moving us forward. And I just, it's like procrastination, I think. And we're no more likely to, it's just like when people ask, like, J.K. Rowling or Stephen King, like, oh, what software did you use to write your book?
Right.
It's like, who the fuck cares? Like, what does that, why?
Yeah.
Why?
Like, I used a napkin, to be honest.
Exactly. Though, that's not the thing that makes them good.
Yeah.
It's not.
Wow. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears and get into this whole idea of a company of one. And I think, you know, I want to frame it by talking about this, what you said in the book. You said society has ingrained into us a very particular idea of what success in business looks like. You work as many hours as possible. And when your business starts to do well, you scale everything up in every direction. To this day, this strategy is considered what it takes to be a success in business, solving problems by adding more to the solution. Where does that come from, and why did you decide to take a very contrarian viewpoint to this?
Yeah, I think that comes from just the, it's funny, like, we think of business as basically starting at the Industrial Revolution, and it had, like, commerce has existed for quite a while before that. I feel like businesses and economies and corporations at scale have existed only for a short time, one, and two, only made sense for a short time, because things like the Ford factory or those sorts of things, like, it was cheaper to make cars en masse. There needed to be high adoption rates for these things to take off. And a lot of businesses were like that. And I mean, some businesses still are, but I think that this idea that more is better is wrong, first of all. And I mean, I spent years looking at research and gaining stories for the book to kind of prove the point that that isn't the case. But I also think that I think it's just human nature. Like I think, and I talked to Danielle, and there's an interview in the book with Danielle, and she's like, it's just so understandably human to want to be loved and to want to be valued and to want people to respect your opinions or your business. And like, when you think about it, it's like, if I go to a dinner party and somebody's like, not what do you do? Cause that's fairly easy to answer. Not always for me, not really, but for a lot of people it's easy to answer. But if you kind of get into the makings of like, well, what do you do all day? It's like, if I tell people like I sit in my home office in my sweatpants at a computer and it's the most boring, like if you watched me do my work, right, you would be bored to tears in about 30 seconds. It's yeah, not exciting. But if I told people like, oh, I run a business, I run a profitable business, I run a successful business. But if I told people like, oh, I have a 1,000 employees and 18 offices across 7 countries, like that sounds better. Mm-hmm. Like I think the envy that we have and the keeping up with the Joneses that we have in real life and what drives the machinery of consumerism, like it follows into business. We kind of keep up with the digital Joneses or the business Joneses, and we see people like Elon Musk and think like, oh, I want to be a business person, so I need to like emulate him. And he believes that you have to work 80 plus hours a week. He has a couch in his office that he sleeps in. I have a couch in my office too, but I use it for naps and Netflix. And he feels like he can't take a vacation because the last two times he took a vacation, his rockets had malfunctions or exploded, and in his brain, he hasn't figured out like the difference between correlation and causation. Mm-hmm. But this is the narrative in the business world. I was at the dentist the other day, and there's a BC, I live in British Columbia, BC. So there's a business magazine, BC Business, on the table beside the desk in the waiting room. And it said growth or grow, I think 3 or 4 times on the cover alone, because we just equate this idea like, oh, well, more is better and like bigger is better. And it's not actually the case. Like it's just what gets talked about the most. But even if we look at any aspect of the news cycle, what gets talked about the most isn't always the most logical or isn't always the best or isn't even the nicest, especially in the news. And so just like looking at research and stuff, I just found like there's so many businesses that decide not to grow and end up doing well, or they're making so much money that they don't care about getting press because it doesn't matter because it's so profitable. And I just think that, so a few points on that. I think first that success is personal. Like if we look to somebody else and want to mirror our lives to theirs, we better hope we like what the outcome is. One, if we succeed, and if we fail, we better not feel bad at chasing something we probably didn't want in the first place. And the second thing I think is that there's just this tremendous burden, at least for myself, there's this tremendous burden lifted if I stop thinking that I have to change the world or build a massive business. Like I'm so adverse to stress and responsibility. And the reason I have my own business is because I don't want those things. So I always just want to try to avoid those things. And I like the freedom of having a small business. I like that it doesn't take long to make enough money to be profitable every month. I like that I'm not responsible for the salaries of like 18 people or 1,000 people. And if one of their kids is in university and we have to downsize, like all of these stories have played out in my head, like, oh, if I hire somebody, that might be cool. But then when I think about the obligation of that opportunity, I'm like, oh, they might have a mortgage, or they might have like kids in university, and like, if I have to let them go or if business isn't good, like what's going to happen? I just don't want that. Like, I don't want that for myself. A lot of people don't want that for themselves either.
So we know a lot of you have been listening to us for years, and it means the world to us. What we do here at The Unmistakable Creative wouldn't be possible without the support of our listeners. If the podcast has been valuable to you, one of the best ways you can support us is to subscribe to Unmistakable Creative Prime, which gives you access to transcripts, all of our courses, monthly coaching calls, live chats with our guests, and an incredible community of creatives. And it costs less than you spend on a cup of coffee every month. For the school teachers and people in our education system, Prime is completely free to help you with this transition to teaching online. We've packed it with a ton of value and actionable content, and we hope you'll check it out. Just go to unmistakablecreative.com/prime to learn more. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/prime. Wow. So one of the things you talk about is the traits of resilient people. And you mentioned a couple of different things, you know, one being an acceptance of reality and the second being a sense of purpose. But one of the things that I wonder about is resilience in the face of adversity and what separates the people who are and the ones who are not.
Yeah, it's funny. Like as the what you're talking about is this, a study that I mentioned from Dean Becker, who found that resilience is actually the most useful trait for business success, like more than education, more than training, more than experience, which is good because I have no education. I didn't end up going back to university. Didn't end up going back to talk to the dean of the program and say like, ha ha, that would be fun. Like in my mind, that would be funny. And I'm sure there's some days when I've thought that would be good, but I haven't actually done that. But I think that resilience is, I think more than, like, I think a lot of people who aren't entrepreneurs think that being an entrepreneur is really risky. And I don't think that it is, or at least I don't think that it has to be, especially the way that I kind of describe how business could work in the book. But I think that, so if risk isn't required, I do think that resilience is, because I think that there's so much of work, there's so much of life even that is unknown. And there's so much that we have no control over. Like we can have the best, like, book launch plan. And like, I don't know if it's going to hit the New York Times. Like nobody does. Mm-hmm. Like there's so many little things that need to happen for those sorts of things to happen. And I think that just being able to accept that we don't control anything. Somebody emailed me yesterday and they're like, well, what do you do about hecklers, like online hecklers of your work? I'm like, it doesn't bother me because I don't care. Because as soon as I release something into the world, it's not mine anymore. It's everybody that wants to consume it. And that takes a bit of work and mindset to kind of come to that point. But I also think that it sets up this resilience, because I know that like I can only control what I write. I can't control what other people think of my writing. And I especially know that not everybody's going to like it. But I can't control it. I don't want to make people like my writing. Mm-hmm. I just want the people who would benefit from it to read it and hopefully enjoy it. And if they don't, that's okay. And I think the other parts of resilience are also important, like having a sense of purpose, because not every day is a good day. Even if you work for yourself, even if you have like this wonderful lifestyle business and you're doing something that matters, like some days are garbage. Like some days are just stressful. Some days is just too much. And I think if we have a sense of purpose, we can ride out those bad times. Like we can love the work we do, but not love every single trapping of that work. And then the other thing is just the ability to adapt. Like we just have to kind of roll with the punches a lot of times. And I think this is such a useful trait to have. And I don't think it's a trait that's ingrained either. I think it's a trait that we can like foster and develop in ourselves, because I don't think people are born resilient. I think that they just have to, they have to work at it. They have to work at like giving up this sense of control. They don't even have to be Buddhist. They can just kind of like work. They can just kind of work at that. And they can work at the ability to adapt. And I really think, man, like like success in the entrepreneurial space, however you define it, I think more comes down to like the ability to have this resilience, the ability to roll with the punches, the ability to like fail a whole ton of times and be able to get back up one more time, or the ability to see like, oh, this thing that I was sure was going to work isn't.
Uh-huh.
Like, how can I move forward? How can I do things? How can I make different choices? I mean, you've talked to James Altucher on the show. His Choose Yourself book is a really good example of that, where there's no, and even Oliver Berkman's book, The Antidote, like there's no, if most of the things that go wrong in our lives aren't going to result in like the worst case scenario, like James talked about in his book, like you don't really run out of ideas. You may have some bad ones, but you can have another one if one isn't working. And then in Berkman's book, The Antidote, he talks about how most worst case scenarios aren't actually the worst case scenario. Like if your business fails, that's awful, but you could start another one. I think he talks about how like the worst case scenario for most people is an embarrassing death,
mm-hmm.
like dying on stage naked. I don't know how you would end up in that situation, but just like something like that, you can't come back from.
Mm-hmm.
But if something isn't working, or if you need to pivot, or if you tried everything you can and it's not going well, like things can change. Things like life is long, man. Like you can try different things, and we never know going into something if it's going to work, at least for anything that matters. Yeah. Like there's no like five tips we can follow to make sure our business is a success.
Yeah, I appreciate this perspective more than you can possibly imagine. I think it's right in line with a piece that I just published today on our blog as well as on Medium. And the title of the piece was "When You Expect Nothing, Everything Comes to You." And it was largely based on my experience with expectations over the course of last year. And I was watching this documentary, which was about this really brilliant Indian composer named A.R. Rahman. And, you know, for those of you listening, even if you don't know who A.R. Rahman is, there's a good chance you've been exposed to his music, because he's the guy who created the soundtracks for movies like Slumdog Millionaire and a bunch of others. And his albums have sold more than Britney Spears and Madonna combined. That's how famous he is. And he said something in that movie documentary. He said, yeah, when you expect nothing, everything comes to you. And, you know, that's such a tough lesson, I think, for creative people and people who do, you know, work in the arts to learn. But I kind of decided to experiment with that for a couple of months and see what would happen. And it seems like the less I expect from my life, the more it keeps delighting me.
Yeah, it's funny. I think that we have this fascination with goals, and we have this idea that like we need to set these huge audacious goals, and they are what move us forward in life, or they are what give us the opportunities that we need. And I don't know. I think that kind of stuff is dangerous and scary to me. Like, I think most goals are fake. Most goals are just artificial targets that we set for the sake of setting an artificial target. Like, oh, I want my business to make $1 million this year. It's like, why? Why do you want that? Why do you need $1 million? Why not two? Why not 100,000? Or like, I want to hit my book to hit the New York Times bestseller. It's like, why do you want that? What are you going to get from that? How do you know what you're going to get from it? Mm-hmm. But I think that the most messed up thing about these like big goals is that they start out as artificial targets. And then as soon as we set them, they're not artificial in our minds anymore. They function then like they're completely made up for the most part. Like sometimes you need to set specific goals. Like I need to make X amount of money to pay my mortgage and feed my kids. I'm not talking about those kind of goals. I'm talking about the pie in the sky ones. But these made up numbers, they function, or these made up things, they just function as like unnecessary stress until they're achieved or abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I was listening to an interview with the Nasty Gal founder, Sophia Amorosa.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she was talking about how she had like a year or two into her Nasty Gal business. She was doing so well, and venture capitalists came calling, and she was like, okay, maybe. Like, she had a profitable business. She's like, okay, maybe. And then they were talking about like goals, and they were talking about, well, you have like, I think it was like $24 million a year in revenue. And so they're like, well, why don't we go for $120 million of revenue for next year? It's like, why? Who pulled this number out of whose ass to come to this? And I think they hit something like $60 million instead, but it was a failure. And like, what kind of messed up thing has to happen when $60 million in revenue is like, wah, wah, wah. Yeah. Like, well, we tried. We only made $60 million. And then that kind of created a spiral of like the valuation of her business from the first investors led to not being able to get more investors because the growth wasn't at a rate that they thought it would be, and the company was overvalued. And like, she learned a lot. She's probably one of my favorite business people because she's awesome.
Yeah.
But like, in learning that lesson, like she took a profitable business, like focused on growth, and then had to basically shutter it down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, when we set these goals, even for myself, like when I started work like 20 years ago, I was like, I'll be successful if I make $1 million a year. And I started working like 16-hour days. And like after a month or two, I was like, why am I doing this again? And there was like no actual reason. I'm like, why do I need $1 million? And there was no answer to that. And I was like, this is like, why? Why am I doing this? Like, this is just bad. But that's how, like, that's kind of the way that society works is like, well, we need to like continue to grow, continue for more, continue to consume. And like, there's not very many resources on the planet or in business that are infinite, right? Like, that's kind of why we've fucked our environment up because there aren't infinite resources. And if we look at like unmanaged rapid growth and like anything other than business, like in biology, that's called cancer, and cancer isn't a good thing. Right. Like, but this is the way, like, oh, this is how business works. This is how capitalism works. This is what we need to do to succeed. And it's like, why? I feel like I'm the guy in the back. I feel like I'm Hans Molman, to make like the randomest Simpsons reference. I feel like I'm Hans Molman, like raising my hand. Like for some reason, there's a bunch of adults in a class in an episode of The Simpsons, and he just kept asking questions and they were bad. But I feel like I'm that guy, but the questions aren't bad. They're logical, at least to me.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, it's interesting because, you know, you have an entire section in this book about staying small as the end goal, which I think makes a, you know, a perfect segue from what we were just talking about. And, you know, you say that too often businesses forget about their current audience, the people who are already listening, buying, and engaging. These should be the most important people in your business, you know, far more so than anyone you wish you were reaching. And I think that really struck me because, you know, people have often asked us, why haven't you guys done a podcasting course? I was like, because we don't know shit about how to market a podcast. Like, we literally don't. We don't know any tactics. We couldn't teach you anything. The only people who've made us grow are our listeners. And that's happened very organically over 10 years. Like, we've never participated in review exchanges or any of that. But this was such a reinforcement of that for me because I will tell you, there have been times when I did obsess over metrics. And it's one of these questions has been on my mind lately because I'm, you know, working on this book proposal for an idea about success on your own terms and what that looks like. And one of the things that I started to look at is how we measure our lives. You know, Clayton Christensen wrote an amazing book about this called, you know, how will you measure your life? But I wonder, in the midst of all this, one, you know, how do people serve their existing audience best and maintain this idea? And, you know, for you, how do you measure your life now? Like, what are the metrics that determine, you know, your own version of success?
Yeah. So for the audience piece, it's I've always, for my own business, focused on retention over acquisition. And in focusing on retention, it's really just like paying attention to them, talking to them, and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like my business would be awful if I didn't know my audience. Like, I wouldn't know how to run a business that makes any money if I didn't have direct connection to my audience every week. Like, my Sunday Dispatches newsletter has been around for 6 years. I haven't missed a Sunday other than like scheduled breaks when I'm writing a book or taking a vacation. And that just gives, like, I just have a direct access. It doesn't come, like, the newsletter doesn't come from no reply at Paul. It's like my personal inbox. People are always surprised when I reply. I'm like, what did you replied to me? Like, what did you think was going to happen? I don't employ robots or personal assistants or anything like that. I'm not important enough for either. But I think that the people who are already part of your audience are the most important people because they're already the ones who are paying attention. Mm-hmm. Like, you've already got their attention. You're already doing something that's useful enough for them to stop and listen. Like, I don't understand how they aren't the most important people in every business ever. Mm-hmm. Like, it boggles my mind that that's not the case. And I mean, even to bring up Danielle again, just because her interview in the book was one of my favorites. She talked a lot about how she did focus on growth for a while as well. Mm-hmm. And then she kind of really scaled back, and she was like, I think her mantra or her business, like, mission was to spread light in the beginning, and mm-hmm. then it altered and it updated to like spread light to those who are listening, mm-hmm. or to those who already have a seat at the table,
yeah,
because they've shown up for dinner, kind of thing. And it just makes so much more sense to do that, because like, I know what my audience wants because I talk to them.
Yeah,
I know what they like or dislike about the products I build because I talk to them. I have direct conversations with them. I do live Q&As. We have email exchanges. We talk on Skype sometimes. It just makes so much sense. And then to the point about how I measure business success, I guess, in my own life, it's freedom.
Yeah.
Like, that's the metric. And it's such a, it feels so like hippie or like just out there, but it feels so pragmatic. Mm-hmm. It feels like such a pragmatic way to think for me, because it's like every decision I make in my business, I think that every opportunity has like an obligation on the back end of it. It just has like a prettier positioning because it's an opportunity, but really opportunities are obligations. Mm-hmm. They just sound nicer, right? So I'm always thinking about like, how does this impact my freedom? Like, is saying yes to this going to mean I may have to say no to something that I don't want to say no to down the road? Or is taking this on going to mean that like I'm going to remove options from my life? Like, I really like having options. Like, I don't like to be in a position where like something has to work or something bad's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Or I have to take on this project because I bought like a massive house and a bunch of cars and now I need to sustain my lifestyle. Like, I want to be comfortable, but I want to have like just enough so that I am comfortable, so that I need as little as possible to like cover my expenses and that sort of thing. So I'm always looking for like what option, because life, business, whatever you want to say, is just like us being presented with decisions and having to figure out what the best one is for us. And for me, it's always like, well, what's the outcome of saying yes to this or no to this, and how does it impact my freedom? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how, like, it doesn't always work. Yeah. It's not a perfect system, but I think that any rule that's absolute is too abstract to matter. So, I mean, sometimes I'm going to choose a bit less freedom because it might lead to more freedom in the future. But in general, it's like, if this thing leads me towards more freedom or leads me towards more choice, then yeah, that makes sense to me. I'm going to say yes to that.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting. You talk about an existing audience, and I may have, you know, ran across your feed. I published this piece both on our blog and Medium about how to build an audience of 1,000 true fans in a noisy world, which is, you know, and I said this like close to a decade ago, Kevin Kelly wrote about the idea of 1,000 true fans, 1,000 people who will support your work, buy everything you create, and allow you to earn a living. But as people became internet famous, bloggers became best-selling authors, and social media platforms quantified every aspect of our humanity, we became obsessed with metrics. We started to value hearts over eyeballs and reach over depth, and it kind of worked.
Yeah, it's messed up. Like, if I think about, like, it's just so weird. Like, if I think about, like, say, my mailing list, and I don't know, there's like 30,000 people or something on that, and I could be like, well, that's not enough. Like, James Clear is like maybe 5 or 6 or 1 million,
yep,
like, audience members. But, like, if I think about that, like if I think about, okay, well, let's put all of them in a room.
Uh-huh.
That's a big room. Like that's a huge, I don't know where we're like, that's like half of a football state. It was like half of a big football stadium.
Yeah.
Like even if I just think about, okay, if my open rate's 50%, I put 15,000 people in a room. Those are the people who are paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
I would be scared to talk to 15,000 people. I'd be scared to talk to 100 people. Like that's just, it's just so like when we do start to think about the metrics of that, uh-huh, and we take the people out of it, it's like there's people behind keyboards, and it like it feels abstract, but it feels less abstract to think about it that way than to think like, okay, these are just numbers. Like even if you look at like website traffic,
yeah,
it's like, oh, I got 100 like unique views today. Well, that's 100 people. Like, that's awesome. And even if I think, like, because the book mostly talks about, like, enough and defining enough and thinking about enough. And it's like, if I think about it, if I think about the numbers in that regard, then it feels a lot better and more human to me. Because like, if I think about, okay, my audience size right now, my mailing list size right now, it's at a size where when I send out an email on the weekend, I get 150, 200 replies. And like, I can deal with that. I can reply to all of them. I can read every single one and answer any questions people have. That gets me to know my audience. That's super beneficial to me as a creator, but it's also beneficial to me as a business.
Mm-hmm.
If that grew by 10 times or by 100 times, I don't know how I would deal with the volume. And I probably just wouldn't. I probably just wouldn't be able to answer. I wouldn't be able to read them all. I wouldn't be able to answer them. So in growing my audience larger, it wouldn't make sense for my business. Like it would probably negatively affect my bottom line. Like if I think about it. And so it's just like when we start to think about things in that way and start to think about like, well, how many true fans or how much of an audience do I need where I can pay attention to them almost as much as they're paying attention to me and I can support them and foster relationships with them, then it doesn't like, I don't need more in that case. I don't need to grow to a massive business. I don't need to do like paid acquisition. I don't even know how to do paid acquisition. I don't even have a Facebook account.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know how to do all of these like things to grow because they don't matter to me. And it's just it feels like this is the way business used to work. Like it feels like before the Industrial Revolution, I'm not a Luddite. I think technology really amplifies this. But I think that before all of that, before economies of scale happened, like there were businesses that existed so well, multi-generational, they relied on other small businesses to operate and they just worked. And like everybody was taken care of because everybody took part in a part of the supply chain, a part of the whole. And it made like a functioning ecosystem of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays we can do that, I think, a little better with technology and communication that we have. But like that way kind of worked. Like that way was not bad. So I think like I'm not saying that we close down every single massive company and go back to that. But I think that not every business has to be massive to succeed. I think that companies like Airbnb, for example, like if they had two properties,
mm-hmm,
they're not really going to do very well. But like for a business like mine, a business like yours, it doesn't have to be like 100 people, 1,000 people.
Yeah.
To give us freedom, to give us revenue, to give us profit. Like,
Wow. I want to go back to something, you know, that you said earlier in the book, which I feel is something that's really kind of amplified in the world that we live in. And in my mind, one of the real downsides of what we've done with technology, you said, you know, Socrates said that envy is the ulcer of the soul, meaning we can easily become negatively affected by the success of others, who we are and what we actually want to become. Became overshadowed when we internally compare ourselves to others. We idolize people like Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, and Oprah and think that their path to success creating massive empires is our own key to happiness and fulfillment. And that really struck me because, you know, we had this guy, Will Storr here, who, you know, many of you listening will have heard, who talked about, you know, the fact that we've become self-obsessed and we have no idea what it's doing to us. And that the impact of this narrative is incredibly toxic. And I wonder, you know, how you contend with that. I mean, you just mentioned you don't have a Facebook account. I've been on a 30-day social media hiatus, and I've just noticed suddenly that my anxiety is a lot lower. And I noticed the less time I spend online, I'm not comparing myself to people. I'm not saying, oh, why did this author hit the New York Times bestseller list and I didn't? Like, none of that is happening anymore. And I wonder what your experience with that has been.
Yeah, I mean, we compare our insides to people's outsides. Like, that's pretty much what the internet is. Yeah. Is we see, like, perfectly manicured Instagram. Like, that's why I'm not on Instagram either. It just made me feel bad about myself that, like, my hair isn't as nice as a blogger, or like the view that I have today isn't good, or like if I'm not documenting things, they don't matter. And it's like, actually kind of matter more if I'm not documenting them. Like, my wife was always like, because I've always been into photography, not even caring about posting to social media, but just like photography. And she's like, why are you spending like 50 minutes trying to take a picture of the sunset? Like, the sun is fucking setting. Like, put your camera down and just look at it. How about that? And I mean, it's just so, yeah, it's just, and like just reading studies of like children who are getting depressed, and it breaks my heart. Like, kids who are getting depressed because they can't build like a YouTube channel to like the size of like big YouTubers. And it's just like, that hurt. Like, it sucked. Or like Pat Flynn tweeted yesterday, I think it was, that somebody left like just the most awful, like, I'm not even going to repeat it, comment on his kid's social media, on his kid's YouTube channel. Jeez. I'm like, what? Why? Like, this is just bad. Like, I don't, like, it's hard to exist in a world like that when there's just so much, like, it feels like we're putting our self-worth into, we're saying like our lives only matter by virtue of like how many people are paying attention.
Uh-huh.
And like, when we think about it that way, like that doesn't make sense to me. Like, that doesn't make sense as like a way to measure self-worth.
Uh-huh.
Like, how can self-worth be measured in any way by external factors? It's self-worth, like the first word in the term is self. So it's just hard. And this envy that kind of pops up because of these things, it is really hard. And it's like, even just like in business, it's like reading other bloggers like income reports. Uh-huh. Like, it's cool that they're transparent, and I don't necessarily think that they're inherently bad or wrong, yeah. But like, most of the income reports I see are people who make six figures a month. And it's like, not that many people make six figures. I don't make six figures a month.
Uh-huh.
And it's just, yeah, it becomes difficult. And I just think that there's this like mind, and it's something to work. It's not something I'm even all that good at, but there's a Sanskrit term called mudita, and I'm probably mispronouncing it. But, and it's just, and I think that possibly has the answer to not being envious of others, but finding ways to find joy in other people's success. It means to like, have joy and appreciation in other people doing well or better.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, one, we never know the whole story of anything that we see or anybody that we see online. Like, there's lots of people who post like really great picture, a picture of them smiling, and they're really depressed, or like, we don't see the full story of anything or anybody online.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, it's like, it's not a zero sum game. Like, if somebody's happy, it doesn't mean somebody else has to be sad.
Uh-huh.
If somebody is a success in business, it doesn't mean like, oh, that's full, everybody else fails today. It's like, that's not really how it works. So I think if we kind of work at, and myself included, work at finding the joy in seeing other people do well, or in seeing other people happy, or in seeing other people succeed, then we're hopefully a bit less likely to have that envy that thieves that thieves all the joys.
Yeah. So funny you say that, because I remember Danielle recently wrote a post on Medium about the fact that 2018 was the hardest year of her life. And I remember thinking, I was like, wow, I wouldn't have known that from even seeing her in person when I've had conversations with her. But, you know, I started writing this post. I don't know what it came, you know, it was one of these crazy morning writing sessions. And I was like, you're not a reality TV star. So why do you live like it? And I'm not done with it, but now you've given me some more fodder for it. Dude, this has been amazing, as I kind of expected it would be. You know, it's funny because we haven't really talked about the book, even though we've been about the ideas in the book the entire time. So, obviously, I want to give you a chance to you know, tell people a little bit about the book, where they could find out more about it and all that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the book is, and I feel like good business books are, it's like a philosophy book or a mindset book that's wearing like a business jacket,
or like a
nice gray pencil skirt. It's more of a philosophy book that talks about business than a business book. And I think that a lot of books that are interesting in business are kind of like that. I'm not even saying my book is interesting. I think it is, but who knows? And the other thing is that I think there are definitely a lot of business books that focus on like the blueprint or the formula or the answers. Uh-huh. Company of One doesn't have a single answer in it. It's so funny. Like, even I was talking to my editor, and this is like a year and a half, 2 years ago when I was writing the book, and he was like, well, why don't we end every chapter with directives, with like things that people can do to make sure that they do well. And I was thinking about it. I'm like, maybe. And I started to think about it. I'm like, no, like, wait, there are, like, how can I tell people what they need to do to succeed if I don't know what success looks like to them? So I was like, how about I make them questions instead? Cause like, I don't know the answer, so I can't give people answers, and I can't tell people what the directives are because there aren't any. Like, the book has no answers. So instead we shifted it to, I'm so glad he signed off on that. Yeah. So it's just all questions. Like, the book is just a way to think about the questions you need to be thinking about to determine what enough is in business. You can apply all the things to your life as well, but that's really what Company of One is. And it doesn't literally mean that you operate a one-person business. I don't have a one-person business. It's just more of a mindset. It's just like Tim Ferriss's 4-hour work week. And nowhere in it does he argue that you work 4 hours and stop.
Yeah.
It's just more of a mindset thing. And the book is, I guess, available audio, digital, what's the other one? Physical. Yeah. Actually printed on Amazon, in stores. It's got distribution, so if you want to find it, you can find it in most places.
Well, I can't recommend the book highly enough, and I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think that's a good question. I think that it's, I think it was Carl Jung who said, sounds like such a like dumb way to start an answer. What was Carl's psychologist, Carl Jung? But he said that the privilege of a lifetime is to become who you are. I think that people are drawn to that. I think that it's really hard, just like how we started this conversation about how it would tell people that they don't want a website that's like Danielle Laporte's because it's not going to serve them. Uh-huh. I think that people are like, when you are honest and when you are true to who you are and what you want, I think that draws people to you. I think people are smart. People all have bullshit detectors. People can sense your intentions, whether you want them to or not. So I think that if you operate from this place of like, not what do other people want of me, like we talked about what I did for my first 20 years, but instead if we think about like, what do I actually want? Like, what does success look like to me? What does enough look like to me? And that's the place that we share from. I think that leads to becoming unmistakable. And maybe it's being unmistakable to like 5 people. And what's wrong with that? Maybe it's 100 people or 1,000 true fans. But like, the number at that point doesn't matter because you're making a difference. It's funny, one more story. When I was a touring musician ages and ages ago, it was sometimes difficult because we were like popular enough to tour, but not popular enough to play like massive stadiums or even like huge bars. And some nights it would be, I would get a little distraught because there'd be like 3 people in the bar and 2 of them were just the regular, like old dudes who went to just the bar every single night. And like, it would be difficult sometimes to like continue, but then like some nights there would be like 1 or 2 people there. And I remember one time we were playing a show just north of Vancouver at a, like a House Sound Brewery or something. I don't even know if it still exists. And somebody came up to us after the show and was talking to my wife, who's a singer in that band. And they were like, I just wanted to tell you that, like, I was going through a rough time in my life. And like, I was thinking about ending it. And your music, our music was really, really dark. And they're like, well, that really helped. Like, that helped me understand things, and that helped me kind of think about things in another way. And that helped me kind of get through that. And I'm like, that's the most important thing. Like, that's like, changing one person's mind about something is it's huge. It doesn't matter if we had like 10 followers on social media or a million, like one person kind of taking something that we created and making a change that resulted in something better in their life is just like so enormous that like that has always stuck with me of like one person does, like reaching one person matters, being unmistakable to like a single human being is like the biggest thing in the world.
Wow. Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. It was a real joy to have you back for a second.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
The book is called Company of One. Google it. And I am Paul Jarvis. You can Google me as well. My newsletter is called The Sunday Dispatches. PJRVS.com. That's where I share everything from book ideas 3 years before I write them, like with Company of One, and just things that I'm thinking about and talking about, things like we've just had a conversation about too.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Did you know that every Sunday, our community manager, Milena, sends out 10 key takeaways from episodes just like this one? All you have to do to receive it is sign up for our newsletter. Just visit unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter and you'll get them delivered right to your inbox. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch. The skills that are essential for standing out and thriving, no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.